Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 754 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Spotlight Friday episode, and today I'm going to be focusing on just one comic. I know usually on the Spotlight Fridays I do two or three, but I wanted to dive real deep into the comic I'm going to be talking about today and do a page-by-page recap and give a lot of thoughts kind of as I go along. You know, usually I'll do the recap and then I'll kind of talk about the book and my thoughts about it when I'm done. But this time I think as I go along, I'm just going to talk about the things that stood out to me, maybe some theories. Again, this is a debut issue, so we're not 100% what the story is going to be, and the story may even change based on what happens in the first arc, as they often do. It seems like it's happening more and more. A little bit with comics these days, where the first issue or the first arc kind of leads you in one direction, and then it totally flips around with the second issue or the second arc. And I really like that, actually. It seems to be something that maybe comic readers or comic creators, really, based on publishers' directives and editorial, didn't necessarily want to do those kind of things, I think. Back in the day, with the older comics, they were a bit more traditional in terms of the narrative. But as we've seen so many different creative people from different fields get into the comic industry, whether they're coming from the prose area or film area or whatever it might be, I really think that they're bringing new ideas, new voices, new ways of telling stories, and it's only for the good. It increases the diversity of story, the types of stories out there. And what we really needed to do is increase the audience and the number of comic readers. And the way you do that is by bringing in these other voices that maybe they may have a little bit of a built-in audience of their own that are fans of them from whatever genre they came from before. And that's great to bring more people into reading sequential stories and reading comics, because a comic can be a gateway. If you fall in love with one comic, it can be the way in for you. It can be your bridge into this whole big world where there's hundreds of books out with great stories. And so I think that's important. I think it's important to have a diversity of different kind of stories so you can have something for everyone, and a rising tide floats all boats, which you may have heard me say that before. So bringing in these other people from other fields who have different ideas, and they're introducing things, and it challenges longtime creators to be sure that they're reinventing themselves and they're pushing themselves to create the best stories they can as well. So I say all that to because Rob Sheridan, the writer of this, comes from a background that's a little bit diverse in and of itself, as opposed to somebody who's been trying to break into comics for a long time. Rob's done a lot of interesting things in his life. I think most people who are fans of Rob probably know him from his extensive work with the band Nine Inch Nails. He was their art director, which when you're the art director for a band, especially one as big as Nine Inch Nails, that's a pretty big job in terms of you do just about everything from, designing their website and album covers, music videos, photography, the way things look on stage during tours, all that kind of stuff. And so Rob has had a really broad background in terms of being creative and the way you see things, right? A lot of the things that he's done, I'm rattling off the list here of Rob's accomplishments and the different kind of genres and creative things he's done, most of them tend to be visual. He's doing the album covers and photography and all that kind of stuff, special effects on stage and the way all those things look. And it kind of contributes to the comic medium. But the other thing that Rob has done is he collaborated with creating the game that was built around one of Nine Inch Nails' albums. He's also been a comic fan for, I think, most of his life. I'm pretty sure I read in an interview that he said that it was always his dream to write comics because he loved them as a kid. So again, I think it's really important to bring voices like Rob's into the industry because you're bringing somebody who has experience in other backgrounds, who's lived sort of a different sort of life, not just that traditional writer's life, went to school, studied creative writing, self-published, and then came into comics that way. Rob's journey is much different than that. And again, it brings different experience to the comic world, to the comic industry, and to the story Rob's telling. And so then you get something new and fresh. And I really enjoyed High Level number one. It's why I wanted to spotlight it and dedicate a whole Friday spotlight to it. So let me go ahead and give the rest of the creative team, and then I'll dive into kind of the synopsis and my commentary on the issue at the same time. Like I said, doing it a little bit differently this time. So as I mentioned, the story is by Rob Sheridan. The artwork is by Barnaby Bagenda. And then we have color art by Romulo Fajardo Jr., who, if you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you know that I'm a big fan of Romulo from his work on Wonder Woman with Nicola Scott, all the way back to his work on some Top Cow books way back in the day. So Romulo's been around for a while, and he's an incredibly talented color artist. And then we have letters by Nate Picos of Blambot. And there's a couple of covers. We have the main cover by Guillaume Hospital, and then the variant cover by Francesco Mattino, which is really, really cool. And it shows the main character, 13, she has this little character that's dancing around, this little robot that she's kind of remote controlling. And it reminded me of Clank, actually, the way this little dancing robot looks like, of the Ratchet and Clank video games, if you guys remember those from a few years ago. I'm not much of a gamer anymore, but I do remember fondly those games. And so when I saw that cover, I was like, oh, that's really cool. I definitely have to pick up that alternate cover. So anyway, let me go ahead and dive into the first issue of High Level from Vertigo. It opens with this page that I'm not sure what to make of, because it's so wildly different from anything that we see subsequently in the story, except for maybe one part of the story. Like, I think maybe this guy is familiar and we see him show up later on, and I'll mention it when we get there. But it opens up and we see this man and woman. They're standing on a balcony. It's definitely a fantasy setting, and they're looking out over this, what looks to be a garden. There's walls and bridges in the distance and towers. It looks like there's kids that are playing on the grass below them. And the woman is talking about how she knows they were hesitant to move there. And she refers to this man that she's talking to, I'm assuming it's her husband. She refers to him as Edward. She says, I still have my moments of doubt. I wonder if we did the right thing for the family. And the family is bolded. I'm not sure what that means. But then she says, as she's looking down at these kids, when I see them playing in the garden, I know we did the right thing. And all Richard replies is, indeed. And then she mentions she's going to go relax, and they have a dinner planned that night. And Richard says, oh, you know, of course, that's fine. And as he leans there on the railing of the balcony, looking down at the kids, he seems lost in thought. And then we see a hooded figure show up behind him and says, are you looking for something more? And he seems very surprised that this figure is there. So again, not sure exactly what's going on here. I'll speculate on it in a little bit once we have this character, what I think maybe this character, show up again sort of in the middle of the book. But as we get to the bottom of page one, we get some dialogue, some exposition from somebody, and we're not sure who it is that's talking until we turn to the next page. But this dialogue is talking about having met an old man who was passing through in search of a better life, and he'd lost everything, his faith, his family, and he was desperate for water. Because, again, this world that we're in, if you know nothing about it, you know, you just pick up the book and you start reading. And the solicits in the press that came out before, on the panels at various conventions where it was talked about, the phrase that kept coming up was post-apocalyptic. And the world of High Level, it's sort of a story about So what happens after the apocalypse? We all have seen so many stories and movies and comics that are set in this post-apocalyptic world. Some great tragedy has happened, nuclear war, or an asteroid hits Earth, or whatever, and society is struggling to survive in the wastelands, if you will. Well, High Level is not that. High Level is okay, so what happens after that? What happens after there's been some big disaster, humanity has struggled to survive for whatever, another 50, 100 years, or whatever it might be, 50, 100, 200 years, and then society starts to rebuild itself, and now they're to the point where it's not necessarily a question of daily survival. It's more a question of existing in this world that's been rebuilt when there's so much of the remnants of the previous world to pick up and use, right? So if you were to think, if our society ended tomorrow, right? If there was a big catastrophe, and let's say for the sake of argument that it didn't destroy infrastructure, and there are these weapons that unfortunately are being tested right now, things like viruses or diseases that are genetically manipulated to only attack certain people so that you can introduce them into an area that wipes out the indigenous population and you're left with all their stuff. So let's say something like that happens, right? Some kind of an epidemic, and it wipes out, I don't know, 90%, 95% of the Earth's population. Well, eventually the 5 or 10% that's left is going to reproduce, and they're eventually going to start to form new societies, right? But here's the thing. That society is going to be so wildly different from ours because the way our society has evolved has everything to do with technology evolving along with us, right? And at one point, it was evolving and society was changing and taking shape based on the fact that we were, quote unquote, discovering the rest of the world, which, you know, the argument can be made, well, there were indigenous people there before, and we just kind of took them over, but that's a whole nother conversation. You know, what's the cliche or the saying, history is written by the winners? But anyway, in this situation that I'm describing where a society basically forms with all the tools and the resources and everything already there, it's going to evolve much differently than our society. It's not going to take it's not going to take the same path. And so that's really what we're looking at here with High Level. Society has started to rebuild itself, or has already rebuilt itself to some extent, to a great extent, but it's not really the society that we would recognize or remember because, again, it formed with the technology already in place, with a lot of knowledge already in place that our society, our current society, didn't have. Everything that has to do with the way we behave and the laws we have has a lot to do with the past and things that were necessary to ensure our survival. Well, these people, they had to ensure their survival by surviving in a world where some cataclysmic event made it very hard to survive. But at the same time, there was technology and there was scientific knowledge that we certainly didn't have. And learning all that, again, it went hand in hand. The Industrial Revolution, the computer technology revolution, all that stuff has already happened for these people. They have that technology. They have technology far in advance of what we have currently. So their society evolved in a much different way, and that's sort of at the core of what this story is about, at least the setting of the world. So again, we meet our main character 13 here on this second page, and as I said, we get a little bit of dialogue on the end of the first page, and she's talking about how she met this guy, this traveler, this old man. And he was on his way north, and he was looking for a better life. He'd lost his family, he'd lost his faith, and he was desperate for water. Water is one of those things that can be hard to come by in the world of High Level, apparently. And what he had to trade to 13 for water was an old book. And this old man, who maybe knew something of the pre-apocalyptic world, knew something of society from before, said this book was very important, maybe the most important book ever written. And so 13 says, well, I guess he was lucky to run into me because water's worth a whole lot more than books. But since I had plenty to drink and I, she seems to be a curious person, didn't have enough to read, she went ahead and made the trade, even though the book was falling apart. And as valuable as this guy claimed that it was in the old world before the migration, whatever that is, people thought this book had answers and they lived their whole lives by it. So as she's describing this book, it becomes pretty obvious that she's talking about the Bible. And as far as the visuals on this page, we see 13. She's wearing a gas mask, a blue jumpsuit. She has a hose that's snaking down into some kind of hole in the ground. And she has behind her a van with a pump, a trailer. This van is pulling, and it looks like nothing so much as a big water container or pump of some sort. So, and based on the sludge and stuff next to the hole, and she has this rod that she's poking out, it seems like she's pumping out a septic tank. We see little flies and some little squiggly lines coming up out of this hole in the ground, which seems to me to indicate that it's a foul odor. So yeah, I think she's cleaning out the sewer or the septic tank or doing something along those lines. Pretty gross. So she goes on to say that this sickled man who'd lost everything, he told me he'd found new answers and he didn't need the book anymore. And so he decided to trade it because he was heading to Silver City on top of the world for the salvation that he thinks he'll find there. So that's interesting. Silver City, we don't know exactly what that's in reference to. But on the following page, 13 says, I read this book, and this is where it becomes very obvious that it's the Bible. She read this book, and there was a part in the book where this man went up on top of a mountain. He climbed a mountain to talk to his God, and God gave him a bunch of rules that everybody was supposed to obey. And when the guy comes back down the mountain and shows the rules to his people, they all take his word for it that God spoke to him, and they all fall to their knees. And in her eyes, it's just because some guy climbed a mountain, right? Because they never saw God. They only took the word of this guy that went up the mountain and came back down that, yeah, these rules came from God. And 13 says she told the old man that she didn't even think he was going to make it to Silver City. He looked far too old and frail to make it that far, but the old man didn't care, right? He said, I'm going to find these new rules even if it kills me. And it's interesting. 13 makes the observation, imagine needing so desperately to be told how to live your life that you're willing to die for a myth. And she could be talking about the Bible in that sense, or she could be talking about this old man, right? This old man believes that there's something in Silver City, the promise of a better life, and he's willing to risk his life to get there. Or is she talking about all the people today? Obviously she doesn't know what today is, but all the people who believed in this book, which to her seems completely illogical. And when you think about it, faith and belief in God and afterlife and everything, that's what faith is, believing in something you can't see or touch or prove or exist. So in that way, it's much like a myth. And plenty of people have died in the name of the Bible through the history of man. I don't think anybody could argue that that's not the case. So a real double meaning here from 13. So as she takes off her jumpsuit and her mask, she says, anyway, the book was boring. I should have kept the water. So it's clear that 13 is kind of her own person. She's not somebody who doesn't have opinions. She clearly has strong opinions. That she's a little sassy, I guess you'd say. She's a little kind of set in her ways. Like she has opinions, and she's not afraid to voice them, even if it's only to herself. So as she walks around to the front of the building where she was emptying this the sewer tank or whatever it is, she tells her robot companion, who appears to levitate behind her, Ezra is his name, to wait there while she wraps this up and to keep her eyes open. So I'm not sure if she's heading inside to get her payment for having cleaned the tank. But when she heads inside, it's clear that this building is a bar. And it's there's a big sign behind the bar that says Benny's. And it's a pretty interesting looking bar. It has what looks to be some old school lights, like those mechanical spotlights with the little spotlights that play all around the floor you used to see in dance clubs, hanging from the ceiling. And there's a bar, as I said, there's what looks to be a pinball machine. There's a pool table. So it certainly a place for people to come and relax, but very eclectic when you start looking at the clientele. I mean, there's a guy sitting at the bar that has a giant green mohawk. So maybe that's not so weird. But then there's another guy who has a very open shirt showing off his chest. And I say guy, maybe it's a girl, I don't know, dreads, and what looks to be a beard and a mustache, but also boobs. So not sure there. Then there's this big, muscly black guy wearing a tutu, and it really looks like a ballerina outfit. His shoulders and arms and neck and all are completely exposed, clearly a white tutu. He has angel wings on, and he has some strange-looking wig on as well, but it doesn't seem like anybody's really paying him any attention, any more so than anyone else. We see another woman who's wearing almost no clothes. She has on leather boots that go above her knee and a visor and not much else. Like one of those leather outfits that's just a bunch of straps but leaves absolutely nothing to the imagination. And she's holding somebody on a leash. A guy that's dressed like in one of those, I don't even know what they're called, like the full leather body outfits like that the S&M crowd wears, where it's, you know, even the zipper covering the mouth. And he has he's kneeling on the ground. He has like red underwear on, in addition to like this black leather suit. And he has what looks to be like a dog bowl at his knees that I guess he's eating from. There's another biker looking guy with sort of a black and green tiger print bandana tied around his head and a snake around his neck. So again, it's a very eclectic crowd, and it seems to me like this scene is to show us that if there was one positive to come out of whatever this disaster or apocalypse was, it's that people now can sort of look however they want to look and be whatever they want to be, I guess, and be out in society, and nobody really bats an eye, I guess. I'm not 100% sure, but it does seem to be a very strange and eclectic-looking world. I mean, even 13, she's got on a purple vest. She has on, like, a pink shirt under it, one glove on. Her hair shaved on the sides, long and blue, coming from the top. So as she walks into the bar, I guess it's Benny, the bartender, because again, the place is called Benny's. He spots her and says, "Hey, it's the sewer girl. How's business, sewer girl?" And I love her response. She says, "You know, shitty." And the bartender laughs, saying, "Ah, that gets funnier every time. Here you go, kid." And pours her a drink. And as she sidles up to the bar, this other guy shows up, and he's got... I don't even know how to describe his haircut. These tufts coming out above his ears, and then the rest of it's bald, and then he has like a little spiky growth right kind of at the top of his forehead. And I guess he's kind of drunkish, if you will, based on the way his word balloons look. He's like, "What's your name, baby?" And this is where we find out what our main character's name is for the first time. She says, "My name is 13. I'm not your baby, and you're way too close to me." And he's like, "Oh, what are you lighting up? A little conversation. How about a smile?" And 13 literally picks a bottle up off the bar and smacks him across the face with it, breaks the bottom of the bottle, and the bartender just laughs. So you get the impression, and no one else even bats an eye. So again, you get the impression that not only are you completely accepted no matter what you look like, but everybody is sort of on their own. Like, nobody's gonna stick up for you. So you sort of need to look out for yourself, because it certainly seems like everybody's embracing the sort of live and let live philosophy that applies to what you look like, how you behave. And so if you hit on 13, you're basically taking your life into your own hands, and no one's gonna stop you. Basically, she asked him to leave her alone. He didn't. He paid the price. So he's not dead or anything, even unconscious. He's kind of standing there, holding his head as 13 walks away, and after hitting him, and says, "There, now I'm smiling." And the bartender tells this guy that was trying to flirt, "You must be new here." So again, you get that idea that, yeah, you don't mess with people. You know, you're interested in somebody, you say something, they say no, that's it. So that, at least that's progress in society, as opposed to nowadays. But as we turn the page, we see 13 approaching this girl outside the bathroom. And the one last dialogue box from the bartender says, "Nobody touches 13. So again, she seems to be known there at the bar, but reiterating that guy that did say he wanted a smile must be new there, because clearly everybody knows you don't mess with 13. So 13 ushers this girl into the bathroom. She's wearing, I mean, I don't know if she's supposed to be some kind of sex worker or what exactly, but 13 does hold up a coin to her as she walks up to her, and then ushers her into the bathroom. And the girl says, "You're drawing too much attention." And 13 says, "No, the way this place works is if you're too quiet and you're too unobtrusive, I guess you'd say, if you're too inconspicuous, then that's when people start paying attention to you. They're like, why is this person going out of their way to try to hide? That must mean that they have something to hide, and therefore we need to pay attention." So the woman says, "Do you have what I need?" And 13 says, "Relax, I always deliver," and gives her what looks to be like an old school SD card. And the girl says, "Hey, it checks out. You interested in another job?" And so 13 must be doing a lot more than just emptying sewage tanks. She's brokering information, maybe, or scavenging, finding information from the old world. We're not exactly sure, but clearly it's something that they don't want the wider public to know about, being that they pretended to be heading into the bathroom, I guess, for some extracurricular activities, but really it's just to make this exchange. So once this girl says that the next job is up north, she starts to say near high level, but she can't even get, she says high lev, and 13th, "Nope, not doing it. Only work in Oneida Flats." And the girl says, "Well, I could use someone like you." And 13, clearly a loner, says, "No, I work alone." But as she says that, her watch buzzes, and she sees that outside Benny's, there's a bunch of figures. All we get is the outline, red outlines of the figures, and a greenish glow. She says, "Shit." And the other girl's like, "What's going on?" "Well, it's a Black Helix squad, whatever that is." And the other girl wants to know what they're doing this far south. And 13 says, "Stay here. We need to separate." Obviously, they don't want to be caught. So meanwhile, back in the bar, we see these Black Helix people, squad, military, police force. And we're not exactly sure. But the leader's telling everybody to stay calm. And the bartender is yelling at them, saying, "Hey, you're not welcome here. This is a neutral establishment. So in order for the establishment to be neutral, there's got to be some kind of a war, or some kind of a conflict at least, which means there's at least two sides. Because if you're neutral, you're in the middle. So that means that, you know, there's got to be at least two different factions fighting." So when the bartender says that, the leader of this Black Helix squad says, "Hey, with your cooperation, we'll be out of here in no time." And then the leader holds up a picture saying they're looking for a girl. We know she's been this way. And as he says that, 13 thinks that they're talking about her. And as she tries to start to slip out the back, she hears the guy say, "It's a child." And she's traveling with this man. And he holds out another picture. And so at least 13 knows that they're not looking for her. She thought, you know, said, hey, we're looking for a girl. She had just smuggled something into the bar. So clearly she got the wrong idea. But as the bartender says, nobody's ever here has ever seen those people. He doesn't let kids in here or army goons. So stop harassing his customers. Get out of his bar. And when one of the patrons says, yeah, get out as well, he gets the butt of a weapon to the back of his neck. And the bartender's having a little trouble as well, as the goons, these army goons, are sort of messing with him and roughing him up. And the leader of this Black Helix squad is telling the bartender, I see you Outland rats aren't accustomed to dealing with authority. And we see in the background as this Black Helix squad continues to harass the bar patrons, 13 takes advantage of the distraction to slip out the back. So she's back in her van. She's pulling her tank. We see something burning in the distance. And I don't know if it's the city that she just came from or what exactly it is, but she's telling her drone Ezra, who is sitting in the passenger seat next to her, strapped into a car seat of all things. Not sure why it can't hover there. Maybe it's saving its energy. But anyway, she says, that was close, Ez, but thanks for the heads up, because obviously Ezra was the one that alerted her to these Black Helix squad men beat at the front door of the establishment. Ezra chirps his response to her, thank you. And then 13 says, man, we got to work on that audio chip. You sound like a flying toaster. And then as she pulls in to what looks to be an amusement park called Ordell Fair, she says, damn, it's good to be home. There's a lot of other people there as well, including a taco truck. So it seems to be some kind of community, some kind of commune that it really looks like it's like maybe a traveling fair or some sort of amusement park. That it's got to be an amusement park just based on like the rides you see. Like there's like a Tower of Terror looking thing, and there's a maybe a roller coaster or a Ferris wheel in the background. So it seems something that's a little more permanent than like just a you know, your run-of-the-mill county fair. But anyway, as I said, it seems like other people work there. And as 13 parks her van and heads off somewhere, she has somebody come up and call her name and say, hey, 13. And apparently this guy's name's Jasper. And they haven't seen each other in a while. And 13 says, hey, Jasper, I didn't think you'd be back so soon. And Jasper drops a bombshell on her, saying that it's only going to be for a couple of days. He's leaving Oneida and moving up north to high level. And that is not, you know, again, we saw earlier where 13 didn't want anything to do with high level. We don't know exactly what high level is. We don't find out in this issue either. But clearly not anywhere that she wants to be. We get a few clues about it or what people think it might be like, but we really don't know for sure. But Jasper goes on to say that he needs to move on. The business is down. They've kind of cleaned out and scavenged everything there is to scavenge around there. And, he needs something more. 13 says, what are you talking about, man? There's tons of untapped sites down south. You know, we get a team together, you and me. And Jasper's not having any of it. He's like, I'm too old for that. South is a young man's game. It must be a lot more dangerous down there, I'm guessing. And he says, you know, I've hit my ceiling. I want something more than this. He wants to be able to maybe not work as hard and be able to not retire, but maybe just have an easier life, I guess we'll say. And 13's not buying it. She's like, more, we have everything we need here. It's not fancy, but it's ours. Like, nobody bothers us, right? So what more could you want other than sort of, you know, freedom? And then we get Jasper's idea of what it's like in high level. He talks about fortune and glory and wealth and luxury. And there's purpose to life in high level, because when you live there, you're striving towards something they call ascension, whatever that means. And he says, yeah, it's not just trying to survive. You're working to ascend. And apparently whatever that means, some kind of life after death thing, I guess, or the next stage in evolution. And 13's not buying it for a second. She's like, don't tell me that. You really believe in that city in the sky fairy tale bullshit, right? And Jasper says, you know, I wouldn't expect you to understand. You're kind of off in your own little world with your toys and your secret mission, and I guess that works for you, but it's not enough for me. So kind of verification here from Jasper that we know that 13 is much more than just like a sewer tech, right? She has her hands in a lot of secret dealings, if you will. So even though 13 is a bit upset with Jasper for leaving, she does give him a hug. She calls him an effing sellout and tells him that she still thinks he's a dipshit, but she hopes he makes it. And she acknowledges that probably the only reason she's even bothered by this is because she's gonna miss him. Jasper says, well, you know what? That might be the nicest thing you've ever said to me. You feeling okay? And 13 says, well, it has been a long day. And Jasper's response to that is, shit, man, it's been a long life. So meanwhile, 13 heads around the corner and meets up with her friend Emma. And apparently that was the person who gave her the most recent job. And she says she has a new one for her there as well, if she's interested. And before they get into that, 13 asks if she heard that Jasper's leaving. And Emma says, yeah, I know, I heard. And 13 says, well, have you ever been up there around high level? And now we get Emma's take on what high level is. And it's very different than Jasper's. She says, I want nothing to do with that. And she acknowledges, I heard a very different story than Jasper's. And she hears folks up there live like prisoners, and they're slaving away, you know, living in boxes and eating rations and wearing uniforms, all for the chance of ascension, whatever that means. So a very different take on high level and what it's like up north. And based on these two different versions, you think the truth has probably got to be somewhere in the middle, because Emma goes on to say, yeah, it sounds like a scam for me. Candy for the sweet tooth of fools. And they also mention that nobody who's ever ascended has ever come back. So who knows what really happens in high level, but folks love a good myth. So there's that word again, myth. And when you think about it, so if it's that hard to ascend and it takes years and years to do it, and this is to kind of refute Emma's point here, if nobody ever comes back from high level, wouldn't it be because they have ascended? And why would you ever want to go back to this world if the world of the ascended is so much better? So anyway, Emma says, you know, I love my job. Business is good. And I do have another job for you if you want it. There's an old warehouse where I need you to pick up a chip. And Emma's like, eh, I don't know, man. That place weirds me out. I've never seen anyone there, just drones. I'd have to have time to scope it out. And you're talking about tomorrow. And as soon as Emma says the pay's $1,000, without even batting an eye or pausing to think, 13 says, yeah, okay, I'll take it. Send over the info. I need a shower and a drink. And I love this. Emma says, things change, huh? You can't control everything. And so it seems like, is she commenting on the fact that 13's about to take a mission unlike one that she normally takes? Like, she's taking on a mission where she doesn't have a chance to do her homework. She doesn't have a chance to scout the area out. So things change and you can't control everything. It's a reminder that basically the world is out of our hands. And you could even make the argument that Emma is talking about Jasper leaving. Things change. And 13 has no control over Jasper, whether he leaves or stays. Or maybe it's a bit of both is what Emma's referring to. So as 13 walks off, she says bye to Emma. She heads to her quarters, which looks like a flying saucer that's crash-landed in a tree, honestly. And we get some more exposition as we see the inside of 13's living spaces. Looks like a lot of scavenged computers. We see a bathroom in the background. We see Ezra, the little personal robot assistant, whatever it might be. He's kind of standing there kind of levitating there watching 13 have a drink. And she's talking to us again, saying everyone seems to want to escape from reality and everyone wants to believe there's something more. They're looking for deeper meaning or greater purpose or just finding a way to kind of fill the hours, right? And 13 goes on to say, but what if this is all there is? And as she's thinking these thoughts, you know, she poured herself a drink. She went and took a shower, it looks like. But before she does that, she's dyeing her hair purple. And it's pretty interesting that she's doing this, because it was blue before and now she's going purple. And so I wonder if she's doing it because those Black Helix soldiers just saw her. And even if they weren't looking for her now, they may be looking for her later and they're going to think to themselves, well, yeah, we saw that girl with the blue hair at Benny's, and be looking for a girl with blue hair rather than hot pink hair. Again, it's all speculation. I don't actually know why Rob is having her change her appearance so early in the issue. And again, it's not even that, I mean, she's still recognizable as herself. It's just instead of her hair being blue, it's like this pink color. And the other thing I go back to is what Emma told her about Jasper leaving and how things change and, you know, you can't control it. And certainly 13 can't control Jasper, can't prevent him from going. She couldn't control her environment in the bar, even though it was a place where she was a regular and probably felt safe. There is a distinct lack of control for 13 early on in the story. I mean, it's just the nature of the way the world works now. You kind of have control over yourself and that's it. Everything else is sort of out of your hands. And so what does 13 have control over? Well, not a lot, but she does have control over the color of her hair. So why not make a change, right? Why not? That is something that she can do. It reminds herself that she has power over herself, that she is still her own person, right? Black Helix didn't get her. She's not beholden to Emma to do anything in particular. She's not beholden to Jasper on whether to stay in Oneida or move somewhere else. She really does have control, and it seems like she's coloring her hair to kind of remind herself of that. Here's something I can control. Right. No matter what, this is, no matter how crazy the world gets around me, this is sort of my sanctuary. Right. This spaceship that crash landed in a tree that she calls headquarters in the midst of an amusement park. One other thing I'll mention about this page is in the last panel, we see the final bit of inner dialogue or inner monologue, however you want to think about it, from 13. And all throughout, up to this point, her text was always blue, kind of matched her hair, and now we see it turn pink in this last panel. So I got to think that's deliberate, right? Her speech color is going to match her hair, so that's pretty cool. So after having a smoke and a drink, she grabs her whiskey bottle and she goes to relax, I suppose you could say. Thinking all the while, what if life's just doing the best you can with the hand you're dealt? And what if this is basically as good as it's ever going to get? There is no place to ascend to. There is no time where society's going to reestablish itself to the point where there aren't going to be people on the fringes. Right now, what the world is like, it's as good as it's ever going to get. That's what she seems to be worried about. So 13 picks up what looks to be an MP3 player. She puts on some haptic-looking gloves and says to herself, you know, what if I'm okay with that? Because for as bad as the world seems to be, if this is all she's ever going to get, at least she has her whiskey and she has her privacy. She clearly likes to be alone. And she also has her little dancing robot. Because when she puts on the haptic gloves, we see the scene that played out in the variant cover by Francesco Mattina, as we see this little Clank-looking robot dancing around based on the poses and the movements of the haptic gloves that 13 is wearing. And her last thought is, what if I like things just the way they are? Again, she has a roof over her head. She doesn't answer to anybody. And she's got whiskey, so what more would you want? And eventually she falls asleep laying on the little, what looks to be an oriental rug that she was controlling the little robot from. So the next night in the warehouse district, we see some really large clones kind of prowling and patrolling around this this huge factory building. And we also see that 13 has pulled up. She has her her van there, the tank with the hose running down to what looks to be a sewer. And I think that 13 is actually inside her the back of her van, and she's making some observations that the old drones are all F-200 models. And this job that she took, she's not even sure why it pays so much, because it looks like it's going to be so easy. And she tells Ezra, how much you want to bet that they still have their old firmware? And when she takes a look, she's like, yep, sure enough, no one's updated these things in years. So we can find a quiet way to get rid of them. And she basically hacks into the programming and edits their patrol perimeter to send them on a vacation. Basically, all of a sudden, their patrol area widened by, who knows, thousands of miles? Maybe only hundreds. I think in the next panel she says, yeah, they think they're supposed to be 300 miles east of here. So that's going to keep them busy for a long time, long enough for her to get it done. So basically, they think that the area they're patrolling is 300 miles wide. It's going to take them a while to before they return to this particular area. So 13 tells Ez to hang back. It won't take long. She's going to go inside and retrieve the chip. And as she crawls in under the door, she hears somebody speaking, talking about gods and transcending from the prison of the flesh and prophets of the old world. And 13's like, I need to ignore that. I just need to stay focused on the mission. But the curiosity gets the better of her, and she takes a peek, and she's like, what the fuck? And meanwhile, the voice continues saying that there are heathens that were caused by the Great Disruption, and the Dark Ages fell upon them all, and they were born into darkness, but there's still light in Silver City, so we hear that name again. As 13 realizes that it's time for her meetup, when her watch buzzes, a voice is calling her to come into an adjacent room. And it looks to be an abandoned assembly line factory where 13 and this other contact exchange some code. And the contact says, when I rise, let me rise like a bird joyfully. And 13 responds, when I fall, let me fall like a leaf gracefully. And she says, I'm glad this is over. There's a storm coming. It's 1,000. She's saying, basically, give me 1,000 and I'm going to get this chip from you. So no sooner does 13 hand over the chip than the guy grabs her and says, I'm sorry, I have no choice. As the voice that we heard earlier says, my children, I know you are tired. The long wait for salvation has been fraught with hardship, but your faith has kept you strong. And he starts talking about time for transcendence, final departure from the flesh. And there's still some amongst them who have become weak, but it's because they still have flesh. And we see this giant spider-like creature. He's human for the most part from the waist up, but below that, it's all mechanical legs. Kind of looks kind of spider-like. And one of his arms has been replaced with a circular saw. The other's been replaced by what looks to be a cybernetic hand. And he's preaching on and on about God's wrath upon the blasphemers, and it's turned betrayal into blessing because they've basically been able to capture 13. And they seem to have a disdain for flesh. They seem to want to embrace the technological side of things. And as they strap 13 down, this spider-looking, half spider, half man-looking guy says, you know, look at all that flesh. What are you talking about? Is 13's response. And he says, the worm can't help its sins. It's that corrupted meat. And we're going to make that meat an offering to the gods. We'll purge this person of their filth. So it seems like this cult, for lack of a better word, they seem to want to eliminate all flesh, of which, hey, 13's one of them. They don't want anything to do with her. So they're about to subject 13 to purification, and they ask if she has anything to say before, any words of repentance before purification is taken out. And all 13 has is a smart remark. And so as this this priest of the cult, I guess, is about to cut off her arm, all of a sudden he's shot and I think killed. And a lot of his followers are as well, as the doors burst open and we see these four guys firing into the crowd of cybernetic people. And 13 yells from on top of the altar that she's on, hey, I don't know what's going on. I'm not one of these freaks. They just captured me. And we see this guy come up to her, knife raised. And 13's like, hey, I have on my libs. I'm just a sewer girl. You don't have to do anything to me. And because it looks like nothing so much as this guy's going to stab her. But instead, when his arm comes down with a knife, he says, you're safe now. And he actually cuts her bonds and says, I'm not going to hurt you, 13. So clearly this guy knows who she is. And when 13 turns and looks at him, she recognizes him too. She says, you, what are you doing here? And then they both head outside, and it seems like there's a dump truck there as well to haul all these bodies of these half-human, half-machine people, whoever they were, as 13 and this guy, Akin is his name, are catching up. And clearly there's a previous relationship, probably romantic based on the level of tension, with 13 saying, man, it's been 3 years, and now all of a sudden you show up here? What's going on? And Akin says, no, it's actually been 4 years. Relax, T, let me explain. And I love that nickname for 13, T, right? Cut off the thir, get rid of the N from teen, and you're left with T. It works. Or it works as, hey, that's the first letter of 13, so let's call her T. But anyway, Akin says, let me explain. Emma said you were out on a job, and I decided to come look for you. That's how important it was that I find you. And it's a good thing I did, because, you know, he's implying that she needed to be rescued. And 13 doesn't really give him any credit or gratitude for that. She just says, yeah, good thing. I thought you were up north. What's with the costume and the guns? And Akin says, I joined Black Helix, which certainly will get the attention of 13. And in fact, when we first see him rescue 13, he takes that mask off. You realize that, hey, he was in the bar. He was in the background of the bar when she was there. So he says he was with Black Helix, but none of the other Black Helix guys recognized him. So clearly there's something going on there as well. But 13's reaction when she finds out that Akin joined Black Helix is, you're a war stooge now? Hey man, I thought you'd be some kind of into some kind of righteous dipshittery. And I love that word, dipshittery. But this is, wow, I'm speechless. And Akin, for his part, says, well, there's a first. You know, again, you can tell these two know each other. There's some banter. There's some inside information there, and a little bit more name calling before Akin says, you know what? Things are bad out there. The northern regions have never been more dangerous. There's riots, there's bombing, there's famine, and it's getting worse, and I'm trying to end it. And 13's not buying it for a second. Like, you really, you're a big hero now, big man with a gun. All you're going to do is get yourself killed. And Akin says, well, you would be the one dead right now if I hadn't shown up. Nice arm you still have, by the way. You're welcome. So it seems like he's calling in a favor a little bit. But 13 doesn't want to hear it. She says, now I remember why we split up. What are you even doing here anyway? And this is when we really start down the path of what the story may be all about. As Akin tells 13, I need you to do a job for me, a big job. And 13's like, a job? Is that what it was all about? You came all the way back here to hire me? I don't get it. And Atkins says, well, you're a pain in the ass, but I need someone I can trust. And 13 wants to know, okay, well, what's the job then? And he says, well, it's precious cargo. It's something that everybody's after, something that can end the war. And I can't do it myself because everybody knows me. They know my face. I'm too well known by all the wrong people. But outside of Oneida, no one knows you and they won't suspect you. And so again, 13's like, what do you mean outside? Where am I supposed to go on this mission? What's the cargo? And Atkins says, you know, yeah, you're kind of immune to the war and the way it's been spreading lately. You're not privy to that. But just the fact that you saw Black Helix in Benny's, this is a chance to stop all of that because it's only going to get worse. And 13's like, what are you talking about? What's the cargo? I think this is the third time she's asking, what's the cargo? And Atkins says, well, some want to use it as a weapon. I see it as the only hope for peace. And 13's about to lose it. What's the effing cargo? And Atkins says, you're not going to like it. And as he turns, we see this little girl standing there in the rain. Obviously, the girl that the Black Helix, of which Atkins is a member. So he has her. Clearly, there are factions within Black Helix because, again, there were those Black Helix guys in the bar that were asking for a little girl. And you have to assume they were asking after Minnow. They're Black Helix. Atkins is Black Helix. But yet, here he is hiring his old girlfriend to take Minnow back to High Level. That's where she's from. And 13 needs to take her home. And that's where the story ends. So I mentioned before, it's not the, you know, the most original idea in the world. We've seen this before. Immediately, I think of Waterworld, right, where Kevin Costner had to protect the little girl and everybody was fighting over her because she had a map to dry land tattooed on her back or whatever. And so you immediately start thinking of that. But even though it's not, 100% original idea, it's presented in a great way. It's well-paced. It's gorgeous art. And interesting characters. Like, you know, you could certainly say that 13 is the protagonist. That's pretty obvious. But you couldn't necessarily say she's a hero. She has a lot of flaws. She has a lot of foibles. But she also has some vulnerability. But we only see that vulnerability when she's there alone in the safety of her own domicile, her little, you know, UFO in a tree house sort of thing. Whenever she's in the bar, whenever she's giving us narration about meeting the old guy, kind of denouncing him for faith, same thing with anything from the Bible and the stories that came from there, certainly the way she is with Atkins, there's a wall there. There's a projection she gives of being a tough guy or tough girl, however you want to label it. But it's what she's had to do to survive, right? In the world of High Level, in the world that she lives in the land of Oneida, you got to look out for yourself, right? Just like that scene in the bar where that guy was coming on to her. She didn't like it. She warned him off. He didn't listen. She smacked him with a bottle. That's reality. That's the world she lives in, and she can certainly handle it. But there is that vulnerability when she's by herself, where she has a little bit more doubt, where she dyes her hair because she wants a little bit more control. It's something that she can have 100% control over, is herself, which up to this point, you know, we saw her a couple times want to turn down jobs because they weren't things that she could control. They were outsider territory. She's very conscious, it seems, of staying in the places she knows where she can have the most control, where she has the best chance of survival. And now that's getting flipped, right? She's going to have to go to the place that she was complaining about Jasper wanting to go to Silver City to try to get to High Level. She wanted to stay where she knew the lay of the land and she knew it was safe. So it's a great start. It's very well paced, which, as longtime listeners of the podcast will know, it's the toughest thing to get right. But beyond that, it's interesting twists and takes on old cliches. I really can't wait to see where it goes next. And I keep going back to that first page too, because again, it was fantasy setting. It was so wildly different from anything that came after. And so we find myself thinking, so what was that? Because I forgot to bring it up when I talked about him, but the guy on that first page reminds me of Jasper. If it's anybody in the book, it looks like Jasper. So that got me thinking, is that a flash forward, maybe? Or is the rest of the story a flashback? Like Jasper has ascended? Maybe ascended means you get to be strapped into a VR chair, right? And make up and live in whatever world you want to live in. And he chose to be like the king of some kingdom or such, you know? Again, I'm not sure. It must be there for a reason, but I really think it was Jasper. It's not overt. There's no reason for me to think that other than it looks a little bit like him. And I'm trying to tie it in some way to the story going forward. And maybe it doesn't tie in at all. Maybe I'm completely wrong and it's not an artificial construct, let's say. Maybe he really got transported to another dimension. But it seems to me like it's some sort of, yeah, we're putting you in a stasis chamber or a VR tube or a holodeck of some sort. So I guess we'll come back to it at some point. It has me very, very intrigued. But mostly what I loved about this issue was 13, the main character. Like I said, that duality of the really tough act she puts on for everybody to see, but the vulnerability and kind of the emotion that comes out of her when she's alone. I also thought very well paced, mentioned that already. The dialogue is very good as well, which can be dialogue can be a challenge. Scripting a series can be a challenge when you're a first-time comic writer because it's hard to balance the way you would write prose and how people sound to when they actually talk and kind of have a more sense of movement with a sequential art story. So there's that. And then on top of that, you're adding in the fact that this takes place in the future and you might have some scientific jargon or some jargon that's specific to this world that 13 lives in, you know, whatever, whether it be their technology or equipment or whatever. So those are challenges that are tough for any writer, let alone a really new writer. So props to Rob Sheridan for such a great job of narrative flow, of a tightly paced issue and really intriguing characters. Again, Akin and 13 are immediate fan favorites in my mind. And I'm very, very interested to read more about their adventures. The art from Barnaby Bagenda is really, really well done. It has a little bit of a cartoonish quality, not a lot, but just a touch, just a hint. And it's a great color palette from Romulo Fajardo Jr. I would expect no less. It's they're not really bright colors. There's a lot of grays and tans and sort of neutral colors, but there's pops of bright color here and there. Certainly after 13 dyes her hair from blue to pink, we still see plenty of bright colors in the pink hair of 13. And when we're talking about the future, we're talking about the city. He makes good choices there as well. If you look at Jasper's page, where Jasper's describing Silver City and what Ascension is and everything, it's very brightly colored, very, you know, positive in tone. You turn to a few pages later where Emma is describing what she knows of Silver City or what she thinks to be true, and, you know, the slaves and the prisoners and eating rations and wearing uniforms and such. It's a much bleaker outlook on the future that may be waiting for these people if you go to a high city. And again, it suits the story and the mood and the tone very well, and him being able to flip between those kind of two color palettes makes a lot of sense to me. So again, I think it's a really great start, so well paced, interesting characters, interesting world, interesting premise. There's a lot more to be discovered, I have a feeling. The other thing that's great about it is how invested Rob Sheridan is. It's not just him writing this comic and then doing a few interviews for websites or podcasts here or there. The guy is super engaging on Twitter. There's a high-level Twitter feed where they do giveaways. And what else is really, really cool that they're doing there is Rob's been releasing profiles of other characters on there, so we get a better idea. Like, they released one the other day that was all about Ezra, the little drone that 13 has. So you could read about him and putting out these portfolios and putting out more information. It's great because it feels like you're not waiting as long to get new content. You're not waiting until, you know, the next issue of the series comes out. So that's really great. Plus, it's fleshing out and helping to establish and enrich the world of High Level that Rob has created. So I love that. I hope the series goes on for a long time. I hope Rob gets to tell all the stories that he wants in this world, because it's really interesting. I can't wait to discover more about the world. There's a map of it in the back, which is really great, which kind of gives us an idea of just how far 13 would have to go if she wants to take Minnow all the way from where she is in Ordel Fair all the way to Silver City. It's quite a ways, indeed. So again, it's a great series. Issue 2 is out in a couple weeks. I highly encourage you to go and let your local comic book shop know that you're interested in getting issue 2 so they can up their orders. I haven't heard anything about issue 1 selling out, so I think it might still be available. If it's not, if your retailer doesn't have it or they can't order from order it for you, then you can for sure go to Comixology and order a digital copy there. Again, my highest possible recommendation. This is one of the best comics I've read in a long time. It wasn't, like I said, groundbreaking or most original idea or any of that, but it was just so beautifully done, from the artwork to the, you know, the pencil work to the colors to the nuanced characters. Just a really, really great start. One of those books where you read it and you just say, man, that was really good. I immediately want to read more. I immediately want to learn more about this world. And you add into that the clear passion that Rob has for the project. And I think you can't help but be a fan of it. So absolutely incredible start. Really, really enjoyed it. And it gets my highest possible recommendation. I'm sure that I'll be talking about every single issue as it comes out on this podcast. So whether I do more Spotlight Fridays or we just mention it on New Comics Wednesdays, maybe we'll even have Rob on at some point to talk about the series and, you know, bounce some ideas back and forth about some of the themes that he seems to be exploring. Belonging, it would definitely be one. What goes on with Minnow and the idea of destiny and what you're fated to do, savior kind of stuff, that it could be possible. It's too early to say. But definitely the idea of belonging, being alone, the perhaps the ideas of faith, which were brought up with the whole old man had a Bible angle. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways this story could go, and I'm not exactly sure what Rob wants to explore. And I think at this point, it's part of what I love so much about the story. There are all these little hints of what it could be about that were dropped, and maybe Rob's going to explore all of them. I don't know, but I'm definitely in for the ride. So I hope you guys all enjoyed this episode. Hope you got to check out High Level. It's a really great start for, especially considering this is Rob's debut in the comic medium. So great start. Hope everybody checks it out. And that's going to do it for this Spotlight Friday. Next week on Spotlight Friday, we'll be checking out a few DC books, specifically Justice League numbers 18 and 19, as the totality story really starts up for Chapter 2. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms, All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.